Tonight I'd like to talk about one of the ways to approach dealing with our thinking, and particularly the thoughts that we don't like, the things which disturb the mind and often lead to unhappiness, to distress. Someone came to the monastery recently who is very successful in their career and in their business life, but they said that they're miserable. Said, you don't have to tell me about the fact that they're suffering even when you have lots of things, because I know that I'm stressed out and I can't relax. And even though I've got lots of things, they don't really bring me happiness, because I'm always worried about the next business deal. I'm worried about the people that I'm competing with to stay on top of my field. And I want to stop all this busyness. I want to stop all this chasing around, but how? I feel like I'm wound up and I'm just driven to do all this. How can I stop? And he said, I'm not ready to come into the monastery and give it all up. And that is one of the things which is not uncommon to hear when people come with their declarations of how unhappy they are with their life. They present a sort of black and white solution. Either I've got to stay caught up in all of this, or I've got to come to the monastery and give it all up. And seeing as I'm not ready to do that yet, means I've got to stay caught running around in this treadmill, never finding any peace, never finding any true satisfaction. And of course, that's not the only possibility. It's not that those extremes of either coming into the monastery and giving it all up, or just having to make do with the misery that one is experiencing. There's a lot of work that can be done even if one stays in one's environment, in one's situation, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done before anyone is ready to come into the monastery and take up the monastic life, to give it all away. One has to start where one is, and one has to start in a small way. And this is one of the things which often the mind won't accept, especially if we've been successful in our business career, in our worldly life, and we've reached a high point. We think that we shouldn't have to start at the beginning with all the spiritual practices. We shouldn't need to take things in small steps, because we're too smart for that. We're more clever than that. We should be able to take on something more, at least in the middle range of practice, even if we can't do all the high stuff yet. So we have to really face up to where we are, not because that is where we are as a person, not good enough, but simply to understand the nature of the mind. The nature of the mind is such that if we have been using it, overusing it, overworking the thinking part of it, the planning part of it, the intellectualising part of it, over using our will, determination to get things done, if we've been giving a lot of energy, a lot of free rein to that aspect of the mind, then that aspect of the mind has a lot of momentum. And that momentum is what's driving us. That's why there is this feeling that I can't stop, even when I don't like the situation I'm in, even when I want to change things. The mind is a conditioned thing. It's a produced thing, and whatever we feed it, however we've used it, that's how it's going to be. And if we want it to change, we have to start changing what constitutes the food for the mind, what is producing the mind. We have to understand that it's not just a matter of saying, I don't want this anymore. If the mind has been conditioned in a certain way, has been used in a certain way, then that is going to continue to push the mind along because it has built up an energy of its own. And what we have to do is to gradually, persistently change the ingredients, change what we are feeding the mind, change what we are putting into the mind, in order for the produced phenomenon that we call the mind to become different. When we are looking at changing the mind from this racing, thinking, speeding mind, one of the most important practices that we have to undertake is the practice of renunciation. We have to stop doing some of the things that we've been doing. And we have to stop doing them in manageable amounts to begin with. And this is again where our ego, where our pride gets a little bit offended, because we think we can stop doing what we're doing when we like and how we like. What's this about taking small steps? What's this about little acts of renunciation? Let me try something really drastic. And if we do that, then we find very often that we can't sustain it because we've taken too big a leap, gone too much in the opposite direction to how we've been habitually using the mind. As well as renunciation, we have to feed the mind what is helpful and what is supportive. So it's not just a matter of taking out what's been speeding up the mind, agitating the mind, but also learning what soothes the mind, what pacifies the mind, what helps the mind. So these two strategies have to go hand in hand. And one of the things that we are recognizing when we do this is that we can't control the mind until we start to control what we put into the mind and how we use the mind. This is a very important first step in our understanding. Now, the practice of renunciation is something which very often we shy away from. It often has with us the sense of being something unpleasant, because renunciation means giving up something that we would still like to be doing, still like to be having, that we're still interested in, that we still get pleasure from. That's the essence of renunciation. It's not about just giving up the things which we don't want anymore, that we're not interested in. it has to be something that we would still like to indulge in, otherwise it's not an act of renunciation. So it's about saying no to desire. Fundamentally, that is what renunciation is about. Now, the thing is, when we're starting to change our habit patterns, when we're starting to say no to desire, it's not so important what kind of object it is that we renounce. Desire finds unlimited objects to go after, to be interested in, to want. And whether the object is something to do with our business, whether it's something to do with our bodily comfort, whether it's something to do with the things that we like to eat, whatever the object, whatever the circumstance, the basic thing that's happening is that our desire is being fed. So when we want to start to rein in our desire, desire is the thing which is churning up the mind, propelling us into thought, speech and action. We recognise that we have to start to take some of the steam out of desire. And that's why we practice renunciation. And it doesn't matter which object of desire we start with. And particularly when we recognise that we need to start with something that we can have success with in order to give the mind encouragement, in order to give the mind confidence, in order to prove that it's possible to cultivate renunciation, then it doesn't matter where we start, in what area of our life. The most important thing is to start, to say no to desire. If we have the goal of making big changes, that's great. But we have to start with making small changes and working up to the big changes. Otherwise, we set ourselves unrealistic goals and we can't sustain them. We can't sustain the work that we're doing. So to say no to desire in any area of our life is where we start. We may say no to the second or third of the things that we know we shouldn't eat. We know this isn't good for us. We better not have a third one. Our renunciation is not to have the third one, and then not to have the second one, and then not to have even the first one. Renunciation might mean sitting through the itch on the face without automatically reaching to scratch it. Renouncing that push towards physical comfort. I can't bear the itch. We renounce that desire to have comfort. If you just think about how many arguments arise because we all have different levels of comfort with temperature. I want the fan on. Well, I want the fan on high. No, I don't want the fan on. I like it like it is. And we get into arguments about how high the fan should be, or what temperature the air conditioning should be, or how high the heater should be. This idea of bodily comfort can lead us into all sorts of arguments. So we start with a small renunciation of bodily comfort. It doesn't matter what object we use as our place for practicing renunciation. The object is not so important. Now, obviously, if we know that there are particular areas that are our weak points, then they're the ones that we need to focus in on eventually. And what we're doing as we practice in small ways, start with the easy things, we're doing two things. First of all, we are little by little building up the strength of the mind to tackle those areas which are more difficult, where we do have strong attachment. So every time we practice renunciation, even if it's with something that's not so crucial, even if it's in a fairly mild way, it is strengthening that ability in the mind to say no. And then the second thing that it's doing is it's showing us that we can survive even if we say no to desire. That we can survive if we don't have that second one. That we can survive even if it is hot and there's a bodily unpleasant feeling. That bodily unpleasant feeling isn't going to kill us. And when we experience that we can survive and we're paying attention, we might also notice that there's a very small glimmer of joy in the mind, happiness in the mind, that we've actually been able to control the mind. We've actually been able to say no and mean it and carry it through. The stronger that the mind becomes, the more we start to be able to call the shots in our life. We start with gross things. We start with objects. We start with things out in the world, the things that we can smell, the things that we can taste, the things that we see, the things that we can hear, the things that come in contact with the body. And then we move into the realm of thinking. Because when we really pay attention, we see that it's not so much the objects that assail the mind. It's the thoughts about the objects that really give us a hard time. We can still be wanting something that's long since gone. We can be planning for the next one and go on and on and on in our minds, anticipating the pleasure that's coming. So when we take a closer look at the mind, as we take a closer look to what really brings misery into our life, where we really can't say no, we recognize eventually that it's in the mind itself that we have to start practicing renunciation. We have to start saying no to desire in the form of thoughts. Until we've started to strengthen the mind through practicing with small things, working up to bigger things, objects in our experience, we'll find that we very often don't have the strength of mind to say no to thinking. A thought comes into the mind and it takes over. Even thoughts that lead us into misery, sad memories, thoughts of gloom, thoughts of misery, projections into the future. It's always going to be like this. There's nothing good in my life. Those kinds of thoughts we can't renounce, we can't say no to. And you may wonder, where is the connection with desire? These are things that are making us miserable. Underneath the craving, the desire, is the sense of self. These thoughts that come into the mind These desires that come into the mind, we take to be me thinking. They take to be my thoughts. We identify with these thoughts. We identify with these desires. And whether it's a thought of misery or a thought of happiness, it's still feeding, I'm here, the sense of self. So coming to the point where we can say no to the thoughts, whether they're taking us into pleasure or taking us into misery, is the next stage of renunciation. And that renunciation is built on the strength of mind that we've developed to say no to the objects of desire in our life. It's also built on the understanding that the thoughts that come into the mind don't belong to us. They don't have to be taken as the truth. They don't have to be identified with as me. If we start to examine the thoughts that come into the mind, we'll see that they arise because they've been triggered by something. Not that we have deliberately thought them. They might be triggered by something that we've seen. They might be triggered by something that we've heard. They might be triggered by a memory that's arisen in the mind out of nowhere. And once that memory comes into the mind, it sets in train a whole series of thoughts around that memory. But all of these things arise not through our conscious invitation. They arise very much at random. And when we start to recognize this, then we start to understand that we don't have to jump onto every thought train and get carried away by it. We can start to say no to the thoughts that come into the mind. Just as we would say no to someone who comes as an uninvited guest onto our doorstep. Just because they've reached our doorstep doesn't mean we automatically invite them in. Doesn't mean we automatically invite them in to take over our household. We use our discernment, we use our judgment to see whether this person is a friend or a foe, whether this person is suitable to bring into our house, suitable to keep company with. And this is what we start to do with the thoughts that arrive at the doorstep of the mind. Instead of just automatically inviting them in and letting them to take over, we practice taking a look at them, discerning whether they're helpful or unhelpful, whether they're worth keeping company with, and if not, we say no to them. We begin to renounce the thoughts that arrive on the doorstep. When we contemplate this, when we reflect on why it is so hard to renounce even those ones which bring us misery, partly it's because we identify with them, but partly because it's a habit pattern to just allow any kind of thought to come in. When the same kinds of thoughts keep arising again and again, we very often wrongly assume that then they must be the truth because here they are back again. But again, if we understand that the mind is a produced phenomenon, it arises depending on what it's fed. If we're fed the same things again and again and again, over time, that becomes what just automatically arises because it's happened so many times. That kind of thinking, that kind of thought has been fed so often. We've got an accumulation, a stockpile of those kinds of thoughts. And so when there's an opportunity, they're the ones that front up on the doorstep, simply because that's what we've accumulated. And so we may have to say no to that same thought many, many times before we wear it out. So we need to be very patient. We need to be forbearing. We need to be willing to bear with the discomfort of turning away again and again and again. These qualities like patience and forbearance, willingness to persevere, determination, these are all of the wholesome mind states that we have to introduce into the mind. These are the good food that we have to feed the mind if we're going to make changes in our way of thinking and in our habit patterns, particularly in relation to desire. Now, for the person who was mentioning that their life is miserable, even though they have so much in terms of worldly success, and not knowing where to start to turn their life around, the encouragement is to start in small ways to say no to desire. And to say no to desire so that one can eventually get good enough, strong enough at saying no to desire to be able to say no to thinking, to thoughts. And to feed the mind the kind of wholesome qualities that are going to help the mind to become even stronger. When we understand the mind, we understand that every thought that we entertain, even if it's a good thought, is friction in the mind. Every thought, even if it's a good thought, because it stirs the mind up, activates the mind, is a source of irritation. Now, thoughts that are based in generosity, loving kindness, honesty, those kinds of thoughts stir the mind less, but they stir the mind still. Thoughts of ill will, anger, jealousy, resentment, those ones really irritate the mind. So we have to also start to give the mind the experience of freedom from irritation. And again, we undertake this practice in a gradual way. One of the first things that we start to pay attention to is what kinds of contacts through the senses stir the mind most of all. Stir the mind to wanting and stir the mind to not wanting. When we pay attention, we become aware that there are certain situations, certain kinds of people, certain kinds of stimulation that really produce irritation, even if it's what we call pleasure. And when we become familiar with those aspects of our life, those situations, we have to start to renounce those kinds of situations, those kinds of experiences which stir up the mind. We have to start to practice restraint. This is one of the essential ingredients in the spiritual life. If we want to reduce the amount of irritation that the mind has to endure through the course of every day, we become much more selective about what we expose the mind to. And some of the things that we have to start to select out are things which we've previously associated with a good time, with enjoyment, with pleasure. But when we take a close look, we recognize that those things actually stir up the mind. They irritate the mind. They make the mind less peaceful, less at ease with itself. And so again, we start in small ways to renounce those kinds of pleasures, renounce those kinds of situations, reduce that kind of impact on the mind. Again, we are experiencing that it's possible to do this and survive. We don't have to be bound to those parts of our life, those areas of our experience, which actually produce misery in the mind. We get the confidence to say no to the things which we previously depended on. And we build up the strength in the mind, the capacity in the mind to say no, and to keep on saying no until we have removed our attachment to that thing completely. And then we experience the effect on the mind of allowing it to be free of that kind of irritation, that kind of friction. And as we observe the effect, we may be surprised to see how much more peaceful it is without some of the things which we previously thought were for its good, for its happiness. We recognize that we've actually found a different kind of happiness that is arising from within the mind itself, independent of that stimulation. But it takes renunciation. It takes a willingness to experiment with our daily life experiences and to give up the things which we still are attached to, which may still be a source of pleasure, but which, when we take an honest look, we recognize that they don't really bring us happiness. They don't really contribute to a feeling of ease, a feeling of inner well-being. When the mind is less stirred up, is less irritated, then we have more clarity to investigate our experience even further at a deeper level, to investigate to see what other ingredients we need to introduce into our life to support the ease that's starting to develop. Keeping precepts is again one of those fundamental practices which we can overlook when we are trying to work out how to be happy. Keeping precepts provides us with very clear guidance on the limits for acceptable behaviour for acceptable speech. Undertaking the five precepts of a lay Buddhist means that we undertake the training to cultivate the ability not to harm intentionally any living being, including ourselves. We undertake the training to try not to take what is not given, to refrain from sexual misconduct, to refrain from dishonest speech, to refrain from using drugs and alcohol. Now, if we just consider any of those precepts and the behaviour that they're addressing, we can recognise quite easily, if we take an honest look, that any of those behaviours, telling lies, engaging in a sexual relationship with someone who is already in a committed relationship with someone else, taking what doesn't belong to us, knowing that it doesn't belong to us, that it's someone else's, all of these behaviours stir up the mind. Doesn't take much to recognise that. They stir up the mind and they add to our discomfort. When we live within the boundaries of the precepts, we are eliminating so much friction from the mind. And not only eliminating friction from the mind, but also, again, uncovering a peace and a happiness which resides already within the mind itself. The happiness that comes from not doing things which cause our harm or cause harm to others. And knowing that within our own mind uncovers a level of peace, a level of inner happiness. And it contributes to our steadiness of mind, our confidence, the confidence that we can start to take control of our life. Keeping the precepts means that we often have to say no to desire. We have to practice renunciation. And following the precepts shows us in what areas of our life we need to develop renunciation. So it's a great help and support when we are trying to cultivate this understanding of renunciation and also gaining the confidence that we can survive without indulging our desires. All of these practices contribute to the strength and the clarity and the tranquility of the mind. And it's from that kind of developed mind that we're then able to make informed decisions about how we should live our life if we want to be truly happy and at peace. When the mind is stirred up, when the mind is being pushed along by its habit patterns, when it finds no inner peace but is constantly looking to the objects of the world as its source of satisfaction, then it's very difficult to make wise decisions about changes that we want to make in our priorities, in our goals, in our way of life. We very often have a muddled way of thinking about things. As the person who spoke to me about being unsatisfied with their life and presenting the alternative as being either staying with things as they are or giving everything up and coming into the monastery. This is a muddled way of thinking. There's no clarity there. There's no true understanding, no true wisdom, no insight into one's own experience. And this is what the ordinary mind is often like. It sees only superficially. It sees very often in terms of black and white. And very often it's many steps removed from what's really going on in our own mind and heart. Many steps removed from our deepest longings. Our deepest longings for true peace. And so unless we cultivate the mind, unless we develop the mind, then we're not going to have the clarity, the strength to look inwards, to be honest with ourselves, and to then make wise decisions. When we have done the preliminary work, practicing renouncing things in small ways, building up our courage and our confidence, practicing restraint, keeping the precepts, then we have a firm basis for developing the mind in meditation. Meditation is the major tool that we have to look inwards, to discover the deeper levels of our experience, the ones that aren't accessible to that frenzied, disturbed, superficial attention that we normally have. In meditation, we're able to see a much deeper level of truth. We're able to access a much deeper level of our own truth about what is important to us and what we would really like to create in our life for ourselves. Sometimes what we would like to create is scary because it seems that it means to get from to that point from where we are means that we have to make tremendous changes. We have to really practice renunciation, and it can be scary to recognize just what we have to do if we really want to accomplish what our heart is really longing for. To give us the confidence and the courage to proceed with what needs to be done, we have to have faith. Faith that it is possible. Faith that there is a way, a path, a practice. We don't have to work it out for ourselves. The Buddha has already done that for us. And then we also have to have faith that we can do it. We have to have confidence in ourselves. And so the renunciation that we practice in the beginning is where we start to build up this confidence, the strength of mind, the courage to challenge, the satisfaction that we can do it little by little. We start in small ways, and that accumulates. And it accumulates until it becomes a real strength that enables us to go further and to take even more drastic measures. Unless we start somewhere, we never develop that inner confidence. We never support the changes that need to be made. And so if we're thinking that we need change in our life, if we're thinking that we're not satisfied with where we are, It's fine to have the goal that we want to accomplish, like we want to be more peaceful, we want to be more at ease. But we have to start where we are, and we have to be prepared to take small steps. And we have to be prepared to renounce in small ways in the beginning. If we combine all of these ingredients, particularly including meditation practice in our repertoire of strategies, then we will find that over time, changes will start to take place of their own. We will start to feel more relaxed. We will start to feel more at ease. We will start to touch happiness. These things arise naturally out of a purified, peaceful mind. And if we practice renunciation, guarding the senses, paying attention to keeping the precepts, and we cultivate the mind in meditation, all of these ingredients will naturally lead us into a more peaceful, a more content frame of mind. And from that place, we can make decisions, we can undertake changes in how we are going to live out our life. Not from what other people have told us we need to do, not from what other people have told us would be good for us, but from what we have discovered for ourselves, from our own experience, is what truly brings peace and happiness into our life. So I encourage all of you who may be at a point in your life where there is dissatisfaction, and that's probably most of us, that you take your courage in your hand and undertake some small acts of renunciation. It doesn't matter what the object is. The important thing is to practice the renunciation itself. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may it help us all to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any questions? The question is, the idea of not wanting to renounce things in our life, can that be considered wanting to control our life and our mind? Yes, that is true. That's when we have the wrong understanding of the mind, when we have this sense of I'm in control of my mind, I can choose what I think, I can choose what I do, and when I want to, I can stop doing this. When I want to feel this particular mood, I can just have it. When I want to get rid of that particular behaviour, I can just do it. I don't need to renounce anything because I'm in control. This is what very often keeps us, prevents us from undertaking the first step in training the mind. And it's based on a wrong understanding of the mind itself. It's based on a sense of ourselves as being something which is apart from the mind, is in control of the mind, rather than seeing that the mind arises produced by causes and conditions, and that it isn't something that is, when in its untrained state, is actually under our control. This is why meditation is also very useful, because it shows us this directly. When we sit in meditation and we want to be peaceful, we find that our mind is still so busy. Maybe it's restless, maybe it's bored, maybe it's tired. We can't just make it do what we want. And if we practice meditation, we discover that for ourselves again and again. We don't have to be convinced, because we know it every time we sit down. But we do see, as we continue to practice, that we make changes. The mind does gradually calm down. Even in one sitting, it calms down. And if we practice regularly, over time we see a tremendous change in the ability of the mind to come to a state of rest. Yes. So there's several questions in that one question. There's a question about, is it wrong to eat fish, pre-packaged fish? It's very hard to be a vegetarian. That's one aspect of the question. And then the other part of the question is that when you have friends who fish and they invite you to go fishing, and fishing's fun and it's exciting and it's part of the being with your mates and all that sort of thing, it's hard to say no. So is it hypocritical to say that you won't go fishing but you'll buy fish at the supermarket? In terms of Buddhist practice, the Buddha didn't advocate that we should be vegetarian. In fact, this was one of the things which led to an attempted schism in the Sangha when Devadatta, who was the Buddha's cousin, tried to make it a rule that all the monks and nuns should be vegetarian. And the Buddha said, that is not how you purify. It's not a matter of what you're eating, whether you're impure or not. It's the state of mind that determines one's purity. And so he didn't allow it to become a rule that monks and nuns could only be vegetarian. But in keeping with the rule on harmlessness, we don't go out and kill food for ourselves, whether we're a lay person or a monastic. Monastics aren't allowed, obviously, to kill animals, and they're not allowed to eat food that they suspect has been killed especially for them. So we aren't able to enjoy the fish that someone's gone and fished for us from the pond. So vegetarianism is a matter of choice for Buddhist practitioners. But if you find that eating meat or even eating fish disturbs the mind because of the fact that it's a living being, then you work around that for yourself. Some people, for health reasons, have to eat fish because it contains oils which they need. Their physical condition is such that if they don't have that in their diet regularly, that they become sick. So there are many reasons why people eat those things apart from just taste or liking them. Going fishing for pleasure is one of those things which, if we take a good look at it, we'll see that it is a mixed experience. There's the pleasure of going and being with our friends. And if we're practicing this path and making the mind more and more compassionate and receptive to the suffering of others, then it's very difficult to enjoy seeing the suffering of the fish when they're hooked and when they're gasping for breath and when they're being taken off the hook and when they're being often cut to get the hook out. It's very difficult to witness that and be present when all of that is happening, because we feel the suffering of the fish, and we also feel what that kind of energy produces in the environment. When we, in order to be able to do that to an animal, you have to generate a hardness in the mind, and that is present as well as the excitement of the catch. So as we practice, we might find that that discomfort outweighs any kind of pleasure that we experience when we're in that kind of situation. And so we might say to our friends, look, you know, I don't want to do that, and I really, you know, it's up to you what you do, but it's no longer enjoyable for me. And we're simply stating a fact. It's not that we're being hard-hearted to our friends, but we recognise this doesn't actually make me feel good. And so little by little we turn away from it. And it may be an act of renunciation when we first say, hey, no, I'm not going to go, even though I enjoy the company, I enjoy all the other bits of it, but I'm not going to be part of that. Well, kiss them goodbye and put them back. It still hurts when they get that hook in them. So, you know, that. And each person is going to have a different level of sensitivity to that. But if you imagine someone hooking you and then saying, OK, I'll let you go, the hook still hurts. And that that sense of, in a way, when food is being prepared and we are nourishing our bodies through the energy of other beings, that energy, that being's life isn't wasted. It's being, it's supporting future life or further life, our life. And this is one of the reflections that we do when we take food in, whether it's plant life or animal life. That this life is a source of nourishment for my life, so may I make good use of it. May I not use it frivolously. May I use it in a way that is helpful and supportive for all life. But to just engage in sport, which causes suffering to our creatures because it's enjoyable for our sense of, you know, being the hunter, being in charge, that's less skillful. But the idea isn't to turn away from our friends. We one of the teachings which I found very helpful through the years came not from a Buddhist teacher, but from a Hindu teacher, and that teaching was that do what you must with people, but never shut anyone out of your heart. So you can say no to the activity that your friends are doing, but you don't have to say no to your friends or shut your friends out of your heart. And sometimes we find just naturally that we no longer associate with those people, because our association with them was always around an activity which we now don't do, but we still don't shut them out of our heart. Yes. The statement is that it seems that enjoyment in the end is something that's done away with, except for the peacefulness of the mind, and that is that's true. There's the mind comes to a place where what was pleasant in the past is no longer seen as being pleasant. Is no longer experienced as pleasant. It's a contact which produces a particular reaction, but the mind doesn't leap to it anymore. The mind actually leaps away from it. but there's an inner happiness which is independent of what's experienced externally. And so that state of inner happiness is where one finds one's pleasure, if you like. But we're talking about a very developed mind. At the moment, when we're trying to accomplish in our practice is to be more discerning in where we find our pleasures, and also in how attached we are to our pleasures, and to recognizing the limitations of those pleasures to bring us true fulfillment and happiness. Right, so the question is, or the comment is around the fact that we can become judgmental when we start to renounce things in our life. We see people still doing the things that we've renounced, and we can start to become judgmental without recognizing that perhaps they've renounced something in another area of their life which isn't so obvious to us. So there's two things here about becoming judgmental. The holier-than-thou kind of attitude which we can fall into. And that is, once we take an honest look at our own mind and we are in touch with the difficulties which we experience in trying to let go of bad habits and introduce new behaviours into our life, as we understand the way the mind works directly in our own experience, we become less judgmental because we see that it's not easy to make the changes that we want to make, even when we've got all good intentions. And so we become a little bit softer around that, around it for ourselves, and appreciating that as it's difficult for ourselves, it's difficult for everyone. And then the other thing is that as we cultivate the wholesome qualities of mind, we feed the mind things like generosity, cultivating generosity, cultivating gratitude, being more honest in our daily life, trying to live harmlessly. All of those practices actually bring a lot of energy, bright energy into the mind. It gives the mind a lot more resilience. And some of the things which we would have reacted against strongly in the past don't quite disturb us so badly anymore, because our own mind has more resilience, more buoyancy, because of the goodness that we are cultivating. And on the basis of that, and also seeing the difficulty of the path, we also actively cultivate compassion and loving kindness towards ourselves and towards others. We recognise the common ground we all share is that we all have suffering, that we're all trying to, in our own way, produce happiness in our lives. And we're doing it more or less successfully sometimes, and many other times not. So we open our hearts much more. And if we find that we are being more judgmental, then we recognise that that's unskillful, and it's something that we need to work on.